Ain't been no shooting in days.
Guns thundered from down the street, then again, and again. Then silence, and the two solid blasts of the shotgun. Both men listened, and no further sound came. A moment later, Pitt Lane called out, and the farmer answered. The clerk nodded.
Same town, he said. Last couple of days, I'd been wondering if I wasn't back in Ohio. Awful quiet lately, he said. Awful quiet.
Tom Kedrick walked down the hall and out the back door. He went down the weathered steps and stopped on the grass behind the building. There was an old rusty pump there, and the sun was hot on the backs of the buildings. He walked over to the pump and worked the handle. It protested, whining and groaning at the unaccustomed work, and finally, despairing of rest, threw up a thick core of water that splashed in the wooden tub. When he had pumped for several minutes, Kedrick held the gourd dipper under the pump and let it fill. The water was clear and very cold. He drank greedily, rested, then drank again. Far up the backs of the buildings, at the opposite end of town, a man was swinging an axe. Kedrick could see the flash of light on the blade and see the axe strike home, and a moment later the sound would come to him. He watched, then wiped the back of his hand across his mouth, and started along and back of the buildings toward the Mustang. He moved with extreme care, going steadily, yet with every sense alert. He wore his 44 Russians and liked the feel of them, ready in his hands. The back door of the Mustang was long unpainted and blistered by many hot suns. He glanced at the hinges and saw they were rusty. The door would squeak. Then he saw the outside stairway leading to the second floor, and, turning, he mounted the stairs on tiptoe, easing through that door and walking down the hall. In the saloon below, Fessenden had eliminated half a bottle of whiskey without destroying the deadening sense of futility that had come over him. He picked up a stack of cards and riffled them skillfully through his fingers, and there was no lack of deftness there. Whatever effect the whiskey had had, it was not on his hands. Irritated, he slammed the cards down and stared at the bartender.
"Wish Dorney'd get back," he said for the 10th time. "I want to leave this town. She don't feel right today."
He heard the shots down the street, but had not moved from the bar.
"Some drunk cowhand," he said, irritably.
"You better look,"
the bartender suggested, hoping for no fights in the saloon.
"It might be some of your outfit."
"I got no outfit,"
Fess replied shortly.
"I'm fed up. That stun out there to Yeller Butte drove me off that range. I'll have no more of it."
He heard the footsteps coming down the hall from upstairs and listened to their even cadence. He glanced up, grinning.
"Sounds like an army man. Listen."
Realization of what he had said came over him, and the grin left his face. He straightened, resting his palms on the bar. For a long moment he stared into the bartender's eyes.
"I knew it. I knew that hombre would..."
He tossed off his drink.
"Oh, I didn't want to leave town anyway."
He turned, moving back from the bar. He stood, spraddle-legged, like a huge grizzly, his big hands swinging at his hips, his eyes glinting upward at the balcony and the hall that gave onto it. The steps ceased, and Tom Kedrick stood there, staring down at him. Neither man spoke for a full minute, while suspense gripped the watchers. And then it was Fessenden who broke the silence.
"You looking for me, Kedrick?"
"For any of your crowd. Where's Shaw? And Keith?"
"Keith's dead. Shaw killed him back up on the salt after you whipped us in the canyon. I don't know where he is now."
Silence fell once more, and the two men studied each other.
"You were among them at Chimney Rock, Fessenden," Kedrick said. "That was an ambush. Dry Gulcher's stunt, Fess."
Kedrick took another step forward, then sidestepped down the first step of the stairs, which ran along the back wall until about 6 steps from the bottom. Then, after crossing the landing, came down facing the room. Fessenden stood there, swaying slightly on his thick, muscular legs, his brutal jaw and head thrust forward.
Oh, hell, he said, and grabbed iron.
His guns fairly leapt from their holsters, spouting flame. A bullet smashed the top of the newel post at the head of the stairs, then ricocheted into the wall. Another punctured a hole just behind Kedrick's shoulder. Tom Kedrick stepped down another step, then fired. His bullet turned Fessenden, and Kedrick ran lightly down four steps while Fessenden smashed two shots at him. Kedrick dove headlong for the landing, brought up hard against the wall, and smashed another shot at the big man. It knocked a leg from under him, and he rolled over on his feet, colliding with the bar. He had been hit twice, but he was cold sober and deadly. He braced himself and, with his left hand clinging to the bar, lifted his right and thumbed back the hammer. Kedrick fired two quick shots with his left gun. One ripped a furrow down the bar and hit Fessenden below the breastbone, a jagged, tearing piece of metal when it struck. Fessenden fired again, but the bullet went wild, and his sixth shot was fired in desperation as he swung up his left-hand gun, dropping the right into his holster. Taking his time, feeling his life's blood running out of him, he braced himself there and took the gun over into his right hand. He was deliberate and calm.
Pour me a drink, he said.
The bartender, lying flat on his face behind the bar, made no move. Tom Kedrick stood on the edge of the landing now, staring at Fessenden. The big gunman had been hit three times, through the shoulder, the leg, and the chest. And still he stood there, gun in hand, ponderous and invulnerable. The gun came up, and Fessenden seemed to lean forward with it.
I wish you was Dorney, he said.
Kedrick triggered. The shot nailed Fessenden through the chest again. The big man took a fast step back, then another. His gun slipped from his hand, and he grabbed a glass standing on the bar.
Give me a drink, he demanded.
Blood bubbled at his lips. Tom Kedrick came down the steps, his gun ready in his hand, and walked toward Fessenden. Holding his gun level and low down with his right hand, Kedrick picked up the bottle with his left and filled the empty glass. Then he pulled over another empty glass and poured one for himself. Fessenden stared at him.
You're a good man, Kedrick, he said,
shaping the words patiently.
I'm a good man, too, on the wrong side.
I'll drink to that.
Kedrick lifted his glass. They clicked them, and Fessenden grinned crookedly over his.
You watch that Dorney, he advised. He's a rattler. Mean.
The words stumbled from his mouth, and he frowned, lifting the glass. He downed his drink, choked on it, and started to hold out a big hand to Kedrick, then fell flat on his face. Holstering his gun, Tom Kedrick leaned over and gripped the big right hand. Fessenden grinned and died.
16. Connie Duane headed for Mustang only a short time after the survivors of the fight at Yellow Butte began to arrive. Restless, after leaving the men who were returning to the squatter's town, she had begun to think of what lay ahead, of Fred Ransom and the impending investigation, and of her uncle's part in it. All of his papers, as well as many of her own, remained under lock in the gray stone house in Mustang. But if she was to get her own money back from Berwick, or was to clear any part of the blame from her uncle, she knew it must be done with those papers. She struck the old Mormon trail and headed south. She was on that trail when the sun lifted, and she heard the distant sound of shots. Turning from the trail, she reined her horse into the bed of Salt Creek and rode south, passing the point where only a short time later, Lauren Keith was to meet his death at the hands of Dorney Shaw. Once in Mustang, she believed she would be safe, and she doubted if anyone would be in the stone house unless it was Berwick, and she knew that he rarely left his chair. Arriving in Mustang, she rode quickly up the street, then cut over behind the stone house and dismounted. She went into the house through the back door and went very quietly. Actually, she need not have bothered, for Alton Berwick was not there. Making her way up the old stairs, she unlocked the door to the apartment she had shared with her uncle and closed the door behind her. Nothing seemed to have been disturbed. The blinds were drawn as she had left them, and the room was still. A little dust had collected, and the light filtering in around the blinds showed it to her. Going to her trunk, she opened it and got out the iron-bound box in which she carried her own papers. It was intact and showed no evidence of having been tampered with. From the bottom of the trunk, she took an old purse in which there were 2 dozen gold eagles, and these she changed to the purse she was now carrying. Among other things, there was an old pistol there, a huge, cumbersome thing. This she got out and laid on the table beside her. Then she found a Derringer 7-shot 22-caliber pistol her father had given her several years before he died, and she put it in the pocket of her dress. Hurrying across the room, she went into the next room and began to go through her uncle's desk, working swiftly and surely. Most of his papers were readily available, and apparently nobody had made any effort to go through them, probably believing they contained nothing of consequence, or that there would be plenty of time later. She was busy at this when she heard a horse walk by the house and stop near the back steps. Instantly she stopped what she was doing and stood erect. The window here was partly open, and she could hear the saddle creak very gently as whoever it was swung down. Then a spur jingled, and there was a step below. Then silence. "So it's you." Startled by the voice, Connie turned. Sue Lane stood behind her, staring with wide eyes. "Yes," Connie replied. "I came for some things of mine. You're Sue, aren't you?" Without replying to the question, the girl nodded her head toward the window. "Who was that? Did you see?" "No. It was a man." "Maybe Lauren has come back." Sue studied her, unsmiling. "How are they out there? Are they all right? I mean, did you see Pitt?" "Yes. He's unhappy about you." Sue Lane flushed, but her chin lifted proudly. "I suppose he is. But what did he expect? That I was going to live all my life out there in that awful desert? I'm sick of it. Sick of it, I tell you." Connie smiled. "That's strange. I love it. I love it, and every minute I'm there, I love it more. I'd like to spend my life here, and I believe I will." "With Tom Kedrick?" Sue's jealousy flashed in her eyes. Yet there was curiosity, too. Connie noticed how the other girl studied her clothes, her face. "Why, where did you ever get that idea?" "From looking at him. What girl wouldn't want him? Anyway, he's the best of the lot." "I thought you liked Colonel Keith." Sue's face flushed again. I thought I did, too. Only part of it was because Tom Kedrick wouldn't notice me, and because I wanted to get away from here, from the desert. But since then, I guess Pitt hates me." "No, brother really hates his sister, I think. He'd be glad to see you back with him." "You don't know him. If it had been anybody but someone associated with Alton Berwick, why..." "You mean you knew Berwick before?" "Knew him?" Sue stared at her. "Didn't you know? Didn't he tell you? He was our stepfather." "Alton Berwick?" Connie stared in amazement. "Yes. And we always suspected that he had killed our father. We never knew, but my mother suspected later, too, for she took us and ran away from him. He came after us. We never knew what happened to mother. She went off one night for something and never came back. And we were reared by a family who just took us in." A board creaked in the hall, and both girls were suddenly still, listening. Guns thundered from the street of the town, and both girls stared at each other, holding their breath. There was a brief silence, then a further spattering of shots. Then the door opened very gently, and Dorney Shaw stood there, facing the two girls. He seemed startled to find the two girls together, and looked from one to the other, his brown eyes bright, but now confused. Then he centered his eyes on Sue Lane.
"You better get out," he said. "Keith's dead."
"Dead?" Sue gasped. They killed him?"
"No, I did. Up on the salt. He drew on me."
"Keith, dead?"
Sue was shocked.
"What about the others? Where are they?"
Connie asked quickly.
Dorney turned his head sharply around and looked hard at her, a curious prying gaze, as if he did not quite know what to make of her.
Some of them are dead, he said matter-of-factly. They whooped us. It was that Kedrick. He spoke without emotion or shadow of prejudice, as though completely indifferent. He had them set for us, and they mowed us down. He jerked his head toward the street. I guess they're finishing up now. The Mixus boys and Fessenden are down there.
They'll be coming here, Connie said with conviction. This is the next place.
I reckon. He seemed indifferent to that, too. Kedrick'll be the first one. Maybe, he smiled. The last one.
He dug out the makings for a cigarette, glancing around the room, then back at Sue.
You get out. I want to talk to Connie.
Sue did not move.
You can talk to us both. I like it here.
As he touched his tongue to the paper, his eyes lifted and met hers. They were flat, expressionless.
You heard me, he said. I'd hate to treat you rough.
You haven't the nerve, Sue flashed back. You know what would happen to you if you laid hands on a woman in this country? You can get away with killing me, but this country won't stand for having their women bothered, even by a ratty little killer like you.
Connie Duane was remembering the Derringer in her pocket, and lowered her hand to her hip within easy grasp of the gun. A sudden cannonade sounded, then a scattering of more shots. At that moment, Kedrick was finally shooting it out with Fessenden. Dorney Shaw cocked an inquisitive ear toward the sound.
Getting closer, he said. I ain't really in no hurry until Kedrick gets here.
You'd better be gone before he does come. Connie was surprised at the confidence in her voice. He's too much for you, and he's not half frightened like these others are. He'll kill you, Dorney.
He stared at her, then chuckled without humor.
Him? Bah, the man doesn't live who can outdraw Dorney Shaw. I've tried them all. Fess? He's supposed to be good, but he don't fool with Dorney. I'd shoot his ears off.
Calmly, Connie dropped her right hand into her pocket and clutched the Derringer. The feel of it gave her confidence.
You had better go, she said quietly. You were not invited here, and we don't want you.
He did not move.
Still playing it high and mighty, are you? You've got to get over that. Come on, you're coming with me.
Are you leaving? Connie's eyes flashed. I'll not ask you again.
Shaw started to speak, but whatever it was he planned to say never formed into words, for Connie had her hand on the Derringer, and she fired from her pocket. Ordinarily, she was a good shot, but she had never fired the gun from that position. The first bullet burned a furrow along Dorney Shaw's ear, notching it at the top. The second shot stung him along the ribs, and the third plowed into the table beside him. With a growl of surprise, he dove through the door into the hall. Sue was staring at Connie.
Well, I never!
Her eyes dropped to the tiny gun that Connie had now drawn from her pocket.
Dorney Shaw, and with that! Oh, just wait until this gets around!
Her laughter rang out merrily, and despite herself, Connie was laughing too. Downstairs, near the door, Dorney Shaw clutched his bloody ear and panted as though he had been running, his face twisting as he stared at his blood. Amazed, he scarcely noticed when Kedrick came up the steps, but as the door pushed open, he saw him. For a fatal instant, he froze. Then he grabbed for his gun, but he had lost his chance. In that split second of hesitation, Kedrick jumped. His right hand grasped Dorney's gun wrist, and Kedrick swung the gunman bodily around, hurling him into the wall. Shaw's body hit with a crash, and he rebounded into a wicked right to the wind. Shaw was no fighter with his hands, and the power of that blow would have wrecked many a bigger man. As it was, it knocked every bit of wind from the gunman's body, and then Kedrick shoved him back against the wall. You ask me what I'd do once with a faster man? Watch this, Dorney. Kedrick lifted his right hand and slapped the gunman across the mouth. Crying with fury, Shaw fought against the bigger man's grip while Kedrick held him flat against the wall, gripping him by the shirt collar, and slapped him over and back. Just a cheap killer, Kedrick said calmly. Somebody has already bled you a little. I'll do it for good.
He dropped his hand to Dorney's shirt and ripped it wide.
I'm going to ruin you in this country, Dorney. I'm going to show him what you are, a cheap, yellow-bellied killer who terrorizes men better than himself. He slapped Dorney again, then shoved him into the wall once more and stepped back. All right, Shaw, you got your guns. Reach!
Almost crying with fury, Dornishaw grabbed for his guns, but as he whipped them free, all his timing was wrecked by the events of the past few minutes. Kedrick's gun crashed, and Shaw's right-hand gun was smashed from his hand. Shaw fired the left-hand gun, but the shot went wild, and Kedrick lunged, chopping down with his pistol barrel. The blow smashed Dornishaw's wrist, and he dropped the gun with a yelp. He fell back against the wall, trembling and staring at his hands. His left wrist was broken, his right thumb gone, and, where it had been, blood was welling. Roughly, Kedrick grabbed him and shoved him out the door. Shaw stumbled and fell, but Kedrick jerked him to his feet, unmindful of the gasps of the onlookers, attracted by the sounds of fighting. In the forefront of the crowd were Pit Lane, Day Reed, and Laredo Shad, blinking with astonishment at the sight of the most feared gunman in the country, treated like a whipped child. Shaw's horse stood nearby, and Kedrick motioned to him. "Get on him, backward." Shaw started to turn, and Kedrick lifted his hand, and the gunman ducked instinctively. "Get up there. Day, when he's up, tie his ankles together." Dornishaw, befuddled by the whipping he had taken, scarcely aware of what was happening, lifted his eyes. He saw the Gruya tied near the stone house. It was the last straw. His demoralization was complete. Feared because of his deadly skill with guns and his love of killing for the sake of killing, he had walked a path alone, avoided by all, or catered to by them. Never in his life had he been manhandled as he had been by Tom Kedrick. His ego was shattered. "Take him through the town," Kedrick's voice was harsh. "Show them what a killer looks like. Then fix up that thumb and wrist and turn him loose." "Turn him loose?" Shad demanded. "Are you crazy?" "No, turn him loose. He'll leave this country so far behind nobody will ever see him again. This is worse than death for him, believe me." He shrugged. "I've seen him before. All they need, that kind, is somebody to face him once who isn't afraid. He was fast and accurate with his guns, so he developed the idea he was tough. Other folks thought the same thing. He wasn't tough. A tough man has to win and lose. He has to come up after being knocked down. He has to have taken a few beatings and know what it means to win the hard way. Anybody can knock a man down. When you've been knocked down at least 3 times yourself and then get up and floor the other man, then you can figure you're a tough hombre. Those smoke poles of Shaw's greased his path for him. Now he knows what he's worth." The crowd drifted away, and Connie Duane was standing in the doorway. Tom Kedrick looked up at her, and suddenly, he smiled. To see her now, standing like this in the doorway, was like life-giving rain upon the desert, coming in the wake of many heat-filled days. She came down the steps to him, then looked past him at Pitt. "Your sister's upstairs. You'd better talk to her." Lane hesitated. Then he said stiffly, "I don't reckon I want to." Laredo Shad drew deeply on his cigarette and squinted through the smoke at Lane. "Mind if I do?" he asked. "I like her." Pitt Lane was astonished. "After this?" Shad looked at the fire end of his cigarette. "Well," he said, speaking seriously, "the best cutting horse I ever rode was the hardest to break. Them with a lot of get-up-and-go to them often make the best stock." "Then go ahead," Pitt stared after him. Then he said, "Tell her I'll be along later." 17. For 3 weeks, there was no sign of Alton Berwick. He seemed to have vanished into the earth, and riders around the country reported no sign of him. At the end of that time, 3 men got down from the afternoon stage and were shown to rooms in the St. James. An hour later, while they were at dinner, Captain Tom Kedrick pushed open the door and walked into the dining room. Instantly, one of the men, a tall, immaculate man whose hair was turning gray at the temples, arose to meet him, hand outstretched. "Tom, this is wonderful. Gentlemen, this is Tom Kedrick, the man I was telling you about. We served together in the war. Tom, Mr. Edgerton and Mr. Cummings." The 2 men, one pudgy with a round, cheerful face, the other as tall as Ransom with gray mutton-chop whiskers, acknowledged the introduction. When Kedrick had seated himself, they began demanding details. Quietly, and as concisely as possible, he told them his own story from his joining the company in New Orleans.
"And Berwick's gone?" Edgerton asked.
He was the older man with the mutton-chop whiskers.
"Was he killed?"
"I doubt it, sir," Kedrick replied. "He simply vanished. The man had a faculty for being out of the way when trouble came. Since he left, with the aid of Miss Duane and her uncle's papers, we managed to put together most of the facts. However, Berwick's papers have disappeared, or most of them."
"Disappeared?" Edgerton asked.
"How did that happen?"
"Miss Duane tells me that when she entered the house before the final trouble with Shaw, she passed the office door and the place was undisturbed and the desk all in order. After the crowd had gone and when we returned, somebody had been rifling the desk and the safe."
"You imply that Berwick returned, that he was there then?"
"He must have been. Connie, Miss Duane, tells me that only he had the combination, and that he kept all the loose ends of the business in his hands."
Cummings stared hard at Kedrick.
"You say this Shaw fellow killed Keith. How do we know that you didn't? You admit to killing Fessenden."
"I did kill Fessenden, in a fair fight before witnesses. I never even saw Keith's body after he was killed."
"Who do you think killed John Gunter?"
Cummings demanded.
"My guess would be Berwick."
"I'm glad you're not accusing Keith of that," Cummings replied dryly.
"Kedrick wouldn't have used a knife," Kedrick replied quietly. "Nor would he have attacked him from behind, as was obviously the case."
"This land deal, Kedrick," Ransom asked. "Where do you stand in it?"
I don't stand at all. I'm simply not in it."
Cummings looked up sharply.
"You don't stand to profit from it at all?
Not in any way."
"How could I? I own nothing. I have no holdings or claim to any."
"You said Berwick promised you 15%?
"That's right. But I know now that it was merely to appease me long enough to get me on the spot at Chimney Rock, where I was to be killed along with the others. Berwick got me there, then rode off on the pretext that he wanted to look at a mineral ledge."
"How about this girl, the Duane girl?" Cummings asked sharply. "Does she stand to profit?"
"She'll be fortunate to get back the money that her uncle invested."
"See, Cummings?" Ransom asked. "I told you Kedrick was honest. I know the man."
"I'll give you my opinion on that after this investigation is complete. Not now. I want to go over the ground and look into this matter thoroughly. I want to investigate this matter of the disappearance of Alton Berwick, too. I'm not at all satisfied with this situation."
He glanced down at the notes in his hand, then looked up.
"As to that, Kedrick, wasn't Fessenden a duly elected officer of the law when you shot him? Wasn't he the sheriff?"
"Elected by a kangaroo election," Kedrick replied, "where the votes were counted by two officials who won. If that is a legal election, then he was sheriff."
"I see. But you do not deny that he had authority?"
"I do deny it."
Connie Duane was awaiting him when he walked back to his table. She smiled as he sat down and listened to his explanation. She frowned thoughtfully.
"Cummings? I think there is something in Uncle John's papers about him. I believe he was acting for them in Washington."
"That explains a lot."
Kedrick picked up his coffee cup, then put it down abruptly. For Laredo Shad had come into the room, his face sharp and serious. He glanced around and, sighting Kedrick, hurried toward him, spurs jingling. Kedrick got to his feet. "What's wrong? What's happened?"
"Plenty. Sloan was wounded last night, and Yellow Butte burned."
"What?"
Kedrick stared. Shad nodded grimly.
"You shouldn't have turned that rat loose, that Dorney Shaw."
Kedrick shook his head irritably. "I don't believe it. He was thoroughly whipped when he left here. I think he ran like a scared rabbit when he left, and if he did want revenge, it would be after a few months, not so soon." "No, this is somebody else."
"Who could it be?"
Tom's eyes met Connie's and she nodded, her eyes frightened. "You know who it could be. It could be Berwick." Berwick had bothered him, getting away scot-free, dropping off the end of the world into oblivion as he had. Remembering the malignant look in the man's eyes, Kedrick became even more positive. Berwick had counted on this land deal. He had worked on it longer than any one of them, and it meant more to him. "Shad," he said suddenly, "where does that Gruya tie in? It keeps turning up again and again. There's something more about all this than we've ever known, something that goes a lot deeper. Who rides the Gruya? Why is it he has never been seen? Why was Dorney so afraid of it?"
"He was afraid of the Gruya?" Shad asked, frowning. "That doesn't figure."
"Why doesn't it? That's the question now. You know, that last day when I had Shaw thoroughly whipped, he looked up and saw something that scared him, yet something that I think he more than half expected. After he was gone down the street, I looked around, and there was nothing there. Later, I stumbled across the tracks of the Gruya Mustang. That horse was in front of the house during all the excitement." Frederick Ransom walked over to their table. "Cummings is going to stir up trouble," he said, dropping into a chair. "He's out to get you, Kedrick, and if he can, to pin the killing of Keith on you, or that of Berwick. He claims your story is an elaborate build-up to cover the murder of all three of the company partners. He can make so much trouble that none of the squatters will get anything out of the land, and nothing for all their work. We've got to find Berwick." Laredo lit a cigarette.
"That's a tough one," he said. "But maybe I've got a hunch."
"What?"
Kedrick looked up. "Ever hear Berwick talk about the Gruya?"
"No, I can't say that I did. It was mentioned before him once that I recall, and he didn't seem interested."
"Maybe he wasn't interested because he knowed all about it," Shan suggested. "That Berwick has me puzzled."
Connie looked up at him. "You may be right, Laredo, but Pitt and Sue Lane were Berwick's stepchildren, and they knew nothing about the horse. The only one who seemed to know anything was Dorney Shaw."
Tom Kedrick got up.
"Well, there's one thing we can do," he said. "Laredo, we can scout out the tracks of that horse and trail it down. Pick up an old trail, anything. Then just see where it takes us." On the third day, it began to rain. All week the wind had been chill and cold, and the clouds had hung low and flat across the sky from horizon to horizon. Hunched in his slicker, Laredo slapped his gloved hands together and swore.
"This finishes it," he said with disgust. "It'll wipe out all the trails for us."
"All the old ones, anyway," Kedrick agreed.
"We've followed a dozen here lately, and none of them took us anywhere. All disappeared on rock or were swept away by wind." "Escovada's cabin isn't far up this canyon," Shad suggested. "Let's hit him up for chow. It'll be a chance to get warm, anyway."
"Know him?"
"Stopped in there once. He's half Spanish, half Ute. Tough old blister, and been in this country since before the grass came. He might be able to tell us something."
The trail into the canyon was slippery, and the dull red of the rocks had been turned black under the rain. It slanted across the sky in a drenching downpour, and when they reached the stone cabin in the corner of the hills, both men and horses were cold, wet, and hungry. Escovada opened the door for them and waved them in. He grinned at them.
"Glad to have company," he said. "Ain't seen a mount for 3 weeks."
When they had stripped off their slickers and peeled down to shirts, pants, and boots, he put coffee before them and laced it with a strong shot of whiskey.
"Warm you up," he said. "Trust you ain't going out again soon. Whiskey's mighty fine when a body comes in from the cold, but not if he's going out again. It flushes the skin up, fetches all the heat to the surface, then gives it off into the air. Man freezes mighty quick drinking whiskey."
"You ever see a Gruya Mustang around, Escovada?"
Laredo asked suddenly, looking up at the old man. He turned on them, his eyes bright with malicious humor.
"You ain't some of them superstitious kind, be you? Scared of the dark, like? And ghosts?"
"No," Kedrick said. "But what's the tie-up?"
"That Gruya. Old story in this here country. Dates back 30, 40 years. Maybe further than that. Sign of death or misfortune, folks say."
Laredo looked inquiringly at Kedrick, and Kedrick asked, "You know anything about it? That horse is real enough. We've both seen the Gruya."
So have I,
the old man said. He dropped into a chair and grinned at them. His gray hair was sparse, but his eyes were alive and young.
I've seen her many times, and no misfortune come my way. Not unless you call losing my shovel a misfortune.
He hitched his chair nearer the woodpile and tossed a couple of sticks on the fire.
First I heard of it was long ago. Old folks used to tell of a Spanish man in armor, riding a mouse-colored horse. He used to come and go about the hills. But the story back of it seems to be that a long time back, some such feller was mighty cruel to the Injuns. That story sort of hung around, and a body heard it ever now and again until about 15, 16 years back. Since then, she's been mighty lively.
You mean you heard the story more since then? Kedrick asked.
Uh-huh. Started with a wagon train wiped out by Injuns up on the salt. Every man jack of them killed dead. Women folk, too, the story was. There was a youngster come off scot-free. Boy, about 5 or 6 years old. He crawled off into the brush, and after, he swore them Injuns was led by a white man on a Gruya horse. A white man in armor.
Wild yarn, Shad said. But you can't blame the kid, imagining things after what he must have seen.
He said that hombre in the armor went around with a long knife, and he skewered every one of the bodies to make sure they was real dead. He said once that hombre looked right square at him, laying in the brush, and he was scared like all get out. But must have been he wasn't seen, because he wasn't bothered.
And this Gruya has been seen since? Shad asked. Regular?
Uh-huh. But never no rider close enough to say who or what. Sometimes off at a distance. Sometimes just a horse, standing. Most folks get clear off when they see that horse.
He got up and brought back the coffee pot.
Right odd you should ask me about him now, he commented. Right odd.
Both men looked at him, and sensing their acute interest, he continued.
Been hunting here lately. Catched me a few bees off the cactus and mesquite, figuring to start a beeline. Well, I got her started, all right, and I trailed them bees to a place far south of here. South and west, actually. Most of this country hereabouts is worked out of bees. I've been at it so long I was working a good ways off. Well, my beeline took me over toward the Hogback. You know that place?
She's a high curving ridge maybe 500 or 600 feet at the crest, but she rises mighty close at straight up to 400 feet.
Crawling up there to locate the cave them bees was working out of, I come on a cave like a cliff dwelling. Only it wasn't. She was man-made, and most likely in the past 20 years or so. What started me really looking was my shovel, the one I lost. She was right there on that ledge, so I knowed it hasn't been lost, but stole off me. So I began hunting around. I found back inside this place it was all fixed up for living. Some grub there, blankets, a couple of guns, and under some duffel in the corner, an old-time breastplate and helmet.
You're serious? Kedrick demanded, incredulously.
Sure as I'm alive. But, Escavada chuckled, that ain't the best of it. Lying there on the floor, deader than last year's hopes, was a young fella. He had a knife, and an old-time Spanish knife that a feller in armor might have carried, and it was skewered right through him.
A young man. Dead? Kedrick suddenly leaned forward. Anything odd about him? I mean, was he missing a thumb? Escavada stared.
Well, now, if that don't beat all, he was missing a thumb and he was crippled up mighty bad in the other arm, carried her in a sling.
Dorney Shaw!
Laredo leapt to his feet.
Dorney Shaw, by all that's holy!
Shaw?
Escavada puckered his brows, his old eyes gleaming.
Now that's most odd. Most odd! Shaw was the name of that boy, the one who didn't get killed with the wagon train.
Kedrick's face was a study. Dorney Shaw, dead. But If Dorney had been the boy from the wagon train, that would account for his superstitious fear of the Gruya Mustang. But to suppose that, after all these years, Dorney had been killed by the same man, or ghost, if you believed in ghosts, that killed the rest of them so many years before was too ridiculous. It was, he thought suddenly, unless you looked at it just one way.
Man can't escape his fate, Escovada said gloomily. That boy hid out from that knife, but in the end, it got him.
Kedrick got up. Could you take us to that place, Escovada? Down there on the hogback?
I reckon, he glanced outside, but not in this rain. Rheumatiz gets me.
Then tell me where it is, Kedrick said, because I'm going now. They were crossing the head of Coal Mine Creek when Laredo saw the tracks. He drew up suddenly, pointing. The tracks of a horse, well shod. The Gruya, Kedrick said grimly. I'd know those tracks anywhere. They pushed on. It was late, and the pelting rain still poured down upon their heads and shoulders. The trails were slippery, and dusk was near.
We better find us a hole to crawl into, Shad suggested. We'll never find that horse in this weather.
By morning, the tracks will be gone, and I've a hunch we'll find our man right on that cliff dwelling where Escovada saw Dorney's body.
Wonder how Dorney found the place.
If what I think is right, Kedrick replied, wiping the rain from his face, he must have run into an old friend and been taken there to hide out. That old friend was the same rider of the Gruya that killed his family and friends with the wagon train, and when he saw that armor, he knew it.
But what's it all about? Shad grumbled. It don't make sense, and no horse lives that long.
Sure not. There may have been half a dozen Gruyas in that length of time. This man probably tried to capitalize on the fears of the Indians and Mexicans who live up that way to keep them off his trail. We'll probably find the answer when we reach the end of our ride. The hogback loomed, black and ominous before them. The trail, partly switchback and partly sheer climb, led over the sharp, knife-like ridge. They mounted, their horses laboring heavily at the steep, slippery climb. Twice Tom Kedrick saw the tracks of the Gruya on the trail, and in neither case could those tracks have been more than an hour old. Kedrick glanced down when they saw the opposite side, then dismounted. This one is tricky, he said grimly. We'd better walk it. Halfway down, lightning flashed, and in the momentary brightness, Laredo called out,
Watch it, Tom! High! Right!
Kedrick's head jerked around just as the rifle boomed. A bullet smacked viciously against the rock beside him, spattering his face with splinters. He grabbed for his gun, but it was under his slicker. The gun boomed again. 5 fast shots, as fast as the marksman could work the lever of his rifle. Behind Tom Kedrick, the anguished scream of a wounded horse cut the night, and Shad's warning yell was drowned in the boom of the gun again, and then he flattened against the rock barely in time to avoid the plunging, screaming horse. His own Appaloosa, frightened, darted down the trail with the agility of a mountain goat. The rifle boomed again, and he dropped flat.
Shad, you all right?
There was a moment before the reply. Then it was hoarse, but calm.
Winged me, but not bad.
I'm going after him. You all right?
Yeah. You might help me wrap this leg up.
Sheltered by the glistening, rain-wet rock, with gray mist swirling past them on the high ridge of the hogback, Kedrick knelt in the rain, and, shielding the bandage from the rain with a slicker, he bound the leg. The bullet had torn through the flesh, but the bone was not broken. 18. When the wound was bandaged, Kedrick drew back into the shelter of the slight overhang and stared about. Ahead and below them was a sea of inky blackness. Somewhere down that mountain would be their horses, one probably dead or dying, the other possibly crippled. Around them, all was night and the high, windy, rain-wet rocks, and out there in the darkness, a killer stalked them. A killer who could, at all of 300 yards, spot his shot so well as to score 2 hits on a target seen only by a brief flash of lightning. Next time, those shots could kill, and there was no doubt about it. Now the situation was clear. It was kill or be killed.
Sure, Laredo said dryly. You gotta get him, man. But you watch it. He's no slouch with that Spencer.
You've got to get off this ridge, Kendrick insisted. The cold and rain up here will kill you.
You leave that to me, Shad replied shortly. I'll drag myself down the trail and find a hole to crawl into down on the flat below this hogback. Might even find your Palouse down there. You got grub and coffee in those saddlebags?
Yeah, but you better not try a fire until I come back. Shad chuckled.
You make sure you come back. I never did like to eat alone.
Slipping his hands under his slicker through the pockets, Tom gripped his guns. His rifle, of course, was in his saddle scabbard. He was going to have to stalk a skilled killer, a fine marksman, on his own ground, in absolute darkness, with a handgun. The killer had a Spencer 56. Lightning flashed, but there was no more shooting. Somewhere out there, the killer was stalking them. He would not give up now, or retreat. This, for him, was a last stand unless he killed them both. His hideout now was known, and if they escaped, he would no longer be safe. That he did not intend to be driven from the country was already obvious by the fact that he had stayed this long. Kedrick crawled out, using a bush to cover his movement, and then worked along the windy top of the ridge toward a nest of boulders he had seen ahead of him by the lightning flash. The wind whipped at his hat and flapped the skirt of his slicker. His right-hand gun was drawn, but under the slicker. He crawled on. Lightning flashed, and he flattened out on the rocks, but the Spencer bellowed, the bullet smashing his eyes and mouth full of gravel. Rolling over, he held his fire, spitting and pawing desperately at his blinded eyes. There was no sound but the wind and rain. Then, in the distance, thunder roared and rumbled off among the peaks, and when the lightning flashed again, he looked out along the high ridge of the Hogback. Lashed by the driving rain, its rocks glistened like steel under clouds that seemed a scarce arm's length above Kedrick's head. Mist drifted by him, touching his wet face with a ghostly hand, and the little white skeletons of long-dead pines pointed their sharp and bony fingers toward the sky. Rain pelted against his face, and he cowered, fearing the strike of a bullet at each flash of lightning, smelling the brimstone as the lightning scarred the high ridge with darting flame. He touched his lips with his tongue and stared until his eyes ached with strain. His mouth was dry and his stomach empty, and something mounted within him. Fear? Panic? He could stay still no longer. With infinite patience, he edged forward, working his way a little over the edge of the ridge toward the hulking black clumps of some juniper, ragged trees whipped to agonized shapes by generations of wind. There was no sound but the storm, no sight of anything. He moved on, trying to estimate how far the cliff house would be, to guess if he could reach it first or get between it and the killer out there. Flames stabbed the night and something burned sharply along his shoulders. He let go everything and rolled, went crashing down a dozen feet before he was brought up in a tangle of dead limbs. But the killer was not waiting. He loomed suddenly dark on the crest, and, crouching like a hunted animal, every instinct alert, Kedrick fired. The dark figure jerked hard, and then the Spencer bellowed. The bullet plastered a branch near him, and Kedrick knew that only his own shot had saved his life. He fired again, and then deliberately hurled himself backward into the night, falling, landing, crawling. He got to his feet and plunged into the absolute darkness, risking a broken limb or a bad fall, anything to get the distance he needed. Then lightning flashed, and, as if by magic, the Spencer boomed. How the man had followed his plunging careen he could not know, but he felt the stab and slam of the bullets as they smashed about him. This man was shooting too close. He couldn't miss long. His shoulders burned, but whether that shot had been a real wound or a mere graze, he did not know. Something fluid trickled down his spine, but whether it was rainwater through the slit coat or his own blood, he could not guess. He moved back, circling. Another shot, but this slightly to his left. Quickly he moved left, and a shot smacked right near where he had been standing. The killer was using searching fire now, and he was getting closer. Kedrick moved back, tripped and fell, and bullets laced the air over him. Evidently the man had a belt full of ammunition, or his pockets stuffed. Kedrick started to rise, but his fingers had found a hard smoothness, not of rock, but of earth and gravel. Carefully, he felt about in the darkness. The path. He was on a path, and no doubt the path, to the cliff house. He began to move along it, feeling his way carefully. Once, off to his left, he heard a rock roll. He took a chance and fired blind, then rolled over three times and felt the air split apart as the shot slammed the ground where he had been. He fired again, then again, always moving. Lightning flashed, and he saw a hulking thing back on the trail the way he had come, a huge, glistening thing, black and shining. Flames sprang from it, and he felt the shock of the bullet, then steadied himself and fired again. Deliberately, then, he turned and worked his way down the path. Suddenly he felt space before him and found the path here took a sharp turn. Another step and he might have plunged off. How near was his escape he knew in another instant, when lightning flashed and he saw far below him the gray-white figure of the Appaloosa standing in the rain. He worked his way down the cliff, then found a ledge, and in a moment his hands found the crude stone bricks of the cliff house. Feeling his way along it, he felt for the door, and then, pushing it open, he crawled into the inner darkness and pushed the door shut behind him. After the lashing of wind and rain, the peace seemed a miracle. Chucking off his soaking hat, he tossed it aside and threw off the slicker. There was a chance the killer would not guess that he knew of this place, and undoubtedly, had he not known, he would have passed it in the darkness and storm. Working his way along the floor, he found a curtain dividing this from an inner room. He stepped through it and sat down hard on the bunk. Feeling for his left-hand gun, he found the holster empty, and he had fired five shots with his right gun. Suddenly, the curtain stirred and there was a breath of wind. Then it vanished. The killer was in the other room. He had come in. Kedrick dared not rise for fear the bed would creak, but he heard a match strike, and then a candle was lighted. Feet shuffled in the room. Then a voice.
Hello, you're in there, Kedrick. There's water on the floor in here. I'm behind a piece of old stone wall that I use for a sort of table. I'm safe from your fire. I know there's no protection where you are. Throw your guns out and come with your hands up. If you don't, I'm going to open fire and search every inch of that room.
Over the top of the blanket curtain, which was suspended from a pole across the door, Tom Kedrick could see the roof in the other room. The cave house was actually much higher than need be. Evidently, the killer had walled up an overhang or cave. Kedrick could see several heavy cedar beams that had served to support a ceiling, now mostly gone. If that was true in the other room, it might be true in his also. He straightened to his feet, heard a sudden move, then fired. From the other room came a chuckle.
Figured that would draw fire. Well, one gun's empty. Now toss out the other and come out. You haven't a chance.
Kedrick did not reply. He was reaching up into the darkness over his head, feeling for the beams. He touched one, barely touched it, then reached up with both hands, judging the distance he had to jump by the width of the beams in the other room. What if it were old and would not support his weight? He had to chance that. He jumped, his fingers hooked well over the edge, and soundlessly he drew himself up. Now, Kedrick could see into the lighted room, but he could not locate the killer. The voice spoke again.
I'm giving you no more time, Kedrick. Come out or I start to shoot. Toss that other gun first.
Silence lay in the room. A silence broken by the sudden bellow of a gun. The killer fired, emptied a six-gun, then emptied another. Tom Kedrick waited, having no idea how many guns the man had or what he might have planned for. Then six more carefully spaced shots were fired, one of them ricocheting dangerously close to Kedrick's head. A long pause, and then a sound of movement.
All right, if you're alive in there now, you got a shot coming. But if you want to give up, you can. I sort of want you alive.
Suddenly the blanket was jerked from its moorings, and Alton Berwick stood in the opening, a gun gripped in his fist, ready to fire. Kedrick made no sound, and the man stared, then rushed into the room. Almost whining with fury, he jerked Kedrick's hat from the bed, then the slicker, and, as the latter fell to the floor, with it fell Kedrick's other pistol, which, falling from the holster, had hooked into some tear in the slicker. He stared at it furiously and then jerked the bed aside. Almost insane with fury, he searched, unbelieving and whining like an angry hound on a trail. He stopped, his pent-up fury worn away, and stood there, his chest heaving with his exertions, his fist still gripping the pistol.
"Gone! Gone!" he cried, as if bereft. "When I had him right here!"
Kedrick's fingers had found a tiny sliver of wood, and deliberately he snapped it against Berwick's cheek. The fat man jerked as if stung, then looked up. Their eyes met, and slowly he backed away, but now he was smiling.
"Well, you're a smart one, Kedrick. Very smart. Too bad it couldn't have been you with me instead of that weakling, Keith. All front and show, but no bottom to him. No staying quality. But," he sighed, "I've got you anyway, and you'll suffer for what you've done."
He scooped Kedrick's other pistol from the floor and backed away.
"All right, get down."
Kedrick dropped to the floor, and the fat man waved irritably at the gun he clutched.
"No use to bluff. That's empty. Throw it down."
"What's it all about, Berwick?" Tom asked suddenly.
"Why this place? The armor. What about Dorney Shaw?" "Ah, how did you know about that? But no matter. No matter."
He backed to the wall, watching Kedrick and holding the gun.
"Why, it was gold, boy. Gold. And lots of it. It was I stirred those Indians up to attack in that caravan. I wanted the gold they carried, and most of it belonged to Dorney's pa. I knew about it. Followed them from Dodge. Knew when they drew it from the bank there, and how much. They fooled me, though. When the Indians hit, they'd buried it somewhere. It could have been a lot of places, that was the trouble. They might have buried it sooner, somewhere else along the trail. I've dug and I've hunted and I've never found it. Maybe I will someday. But nobody else is going to. Wonder why I wanted the land. Profit, sure, but I wanted this place, a couple of sections in here, all for myself. Figured on that, working it out somehow. The gold's somewhere between here and Thieving Rock. Has to be."
Kedrick nodded. "That clears up a lot of things. Now you drop that gun, Berwick, and come as my prisoner." Berwick chuckled fatly.
"Try to bluff me? I'd have expected that from you. Everyone, huh? But you got that Connie Duane, too. By the Lord Harry, there's a woman. No scared of her, not one bit. Drop your gun, boy, or I'll put my first bullet through your kneecap."
He was about to shoot, and Tom Kedrick knew it. Coolly, he squeezed off his own shot, an instant faster. He shot for the gun hand, but the bullet only skinned the thumb knuckle and hit Berwick in the side. The fat man jerked and his face twisted, and he stared at the gun, lifting his own. Coolly, Kedrick fired again, then again. The bullets struck with an ugly smack, and Berwick wilted, the gun going from his limp fingers to the floor. Kedrick stepped in and caught him, easing him down. The flabby cheeks were suddenly sagging and old. Bitterly, the man stared up at him.
"What happened? That...
"The gun was a Walch 12-shot pistol," Tom explained. "I started carrying them a few days ago, replacing the 44 Russians. Berwick stared at him, no hatred in his eyes.
"Smart," he said. "Smart. Always one trick better than me, or anybody. You'll do, boy."
On the streets of Mustang, the sun was warm after the rain. Tom Kedrick, wounded again but walking, stood beside Connie Duane. Shad was grinning at them.
"Look mighty fine in that tailored suit, Tom. You going to be gone long?"
"Not us. We'll be married in Santa Fe, and then we're heading for the Mogollons and that ranch."
"Seems a shame not to hunt for that gold," Laredo complained. "But anyway, the real treasure is that box full of Berwick's papers. Sure make Cummins hunt his hole. But I do regret that gold."
"I don't," Connie replied. It's caused too much trouble. Alton Berwick spent his life and a good many other lives after it. Let it stay where it is. Maybe a better man will find it, who needs it more than we do.
Gosh, Laredo said suddenly. I got a lot of shuck. I'm late to meet Sue. So long, then.
They watched him go, waiting for the stage. Everything was quiet in Mustang. 3 whole days without a killing. The end. About the author. Louis Dearborn Lamour, 1908 to 1988, was born in Jamestown, North Dakota. He left home at 15 and subsequently held a wide variety of jobs, although he worked mostly as a merchant seaman. From his earliest youth, Lamour had a love of verse. His first published work was a poem, The Chap Worthwhile, appearing when he was 18 years old in his former hometown's newspaper, the Jamestown Sun. Lamour wrote poems and articles for a number of small circulation arts magazines all through the early 1930s, and after hundreds of rejection slips, finally had his first story accepted, Anything for a Pal, in True Gang Life, October 1935. He returned in 1938 to live with his family where they had settled in Choctaw, Oklahoma, determined to make writing his career. He wrote a fight story bought by Standard Magazines that year and became acquainted with editor Leo Margulis, who was to play an important role later in Lamour's life. The Town No Guns Could Tame in New Western, March 1940, was his first published Western story. During the Second World War, Lamour was drafted and ultimately served with the U.S. Army Transportation Corps in Europe. However, in the 2 years before he was shipped out, he managed to write a great many adventure stories for Standard magazines. The first story he published in 1946, the year of his discharge, was a Western, Law of the Desert Born, in Dime Western, April 1946. A call to Leo Margulis resulted in Lamour's agreeing to write Western stories for the various Western pulp magazines published by Standard magazines, a third of which appeared under the byline Jim Mayo, the name of a character in Lamour's earlier adventure fiction. Lamour's first Western novel under his own byline was Westward the Tide in World's Work, 1950. Lamour sold his first Western short story to a Slick magazine 2 years later, The Gift of Cochise in Collier's, July 1952. Robert Fellows and John Wayne purchased screen rights to this story from Lamour for $4,000, and James Edward Grant, one of Wayne's favorite screenwriters, developed a script from it. Lamour retained the right to novelize Grant's screenplay, which differs substantially from his short story. Hondo, published in 1953 by Louis Lamour, was released on the same day as the film Hondo, Warner Brothers, 1953, with a first printing of 320,000 copies. With Showdown at Yellow Butte, published in 1953 by Jim Mayo, Lamour began a series of short Western novels that could be doubled with other short novels by other authors in Ace Publishing's paperback twofers. Heller with a Gun, published in 1955, was the first of a series of original Westerns Lamour had agreed to write under his own name following the success for Fawcett of Hondo. The great turn in Lamour's fortunes came about when he was signed by Bantam Books. By 1962, he was writing 3 original paperback novels a year. All of his Bantam Western titles came to be continuously kept in print. There are also several characteristics in purest form that, no matter how diluted they ultimately would become, account in largest measure for the loyal following Louis Lamour won from his readers. The young male narrator who is in the process of growing into manhood and who is evaluating other human beings and his own experiences. A resourceful frontier woman who has beauty as well as fortitude. A strong male character who is single and hence marriageable. And the powerful, romantic, strangely compelling vision of the American West, which invests Lamour's Western fiction and makes it such a delightful escape from the cares of a later time. This concludes the reading of Dead Ringer, A Western Trio by Louis Lamour. Black Rock, copyright 1950 by Popular Publications, Incorporated.
Copyright not renewed. Gamble of the KT, copyright 1951, by Better Publications, Incorporated. Copyright not renewed. Showdown Trail, copyright 1950, by Best Publications, Incorporated. Copyright not renewed. Copyright 2019 by Golden West Literary Agency. This book was read by Lloyd James. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Golden West Literary Agency and was produced in 2019 by Blackstone Publishing, which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Publishing. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.